Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crown Town, Charlotte, North Carolina. In a previous episode, I talked about methods for thinking futuristically. Today, I want to go somewhere a little bit uncomfortable, because you cannot build responsible futures without understanding what happens when futurism loses its moral compass. This is the episode where Jewish futurism gets honest about the movements that came before us and the ones that got it right. Let's get into it, y'all. So, I teach design. And every time I introduce the history of futurism to students, there's this moment I've come to anticipate. I put up the great Italian futurist posters, the bold typography, the dynamic angles and lines suggest speed and motion, the explosive compositions. Students lean forward. They're definitely drawn in. And this work is genuinely exciting looking. And then I tell them who made it and why. And suddenly the room shifts. Italian Futurism, with a capital F, is one of the most visually compelling art movements of the 20th century. And I want to be clear about something before I start critiquing it. It was extraordinarily influential. Italian Futurism fundamentally shaped modern architecture, graphic design, product design, typography, and more. The dynamism you see in the early 20th century advertising, the forward-leaning urgency of modernist typography, the machine aesthetic that ran through industrial design for decades, the idea that designed objects should express speed and energy and vitality, all of that traces a direct link back to Italian futurism. When you look at the sleek aerodynamic forms of mid-century product design, when you look at the explosive diagonal energy of early Soviet propaganda posters, when you look at the typography of sports brands and tech companies today, you are looking at a visual language that the Italian futurists helped invent. It was genuinely revolutionary. It changed how the design world looks and feels in ways we still live inside. That's exactly what makes it so important to understand. And that's exactly what makes its moral failure so serious. Italian futurism is only one of the most morally catastrophic movements of the 20th century. The same movement that produced stunning graphic design produced manifestos glorifying war as the only hygiene for the world. The same artists who pioneered dynamic visual language openly celebrated violence against women. The same movement that claimed to be building the future merged directly into the Italian fascist regime and helped give Mussolini an aesthetic identity that made brutality look like progress. The power of Italian futurism is precisely what makes its failure worth studying. If it had been a minor movement with limited influence, we could have treated it as something like a footnote. But because its visual language became so embedded in the fabric of modern design, because it shaped so many movements that came after it, its ethical failures traveled with it. You cannot fully understand modernist design or avant-garde art or the aesthetics of nationalism and fascism without reckoning with Italian futurism. And you cannot build responsibility in the present without that reckoning. That classroom moment I described is why this episode exists, because you cannot talk about futurism, any futurism, without understanding what happens when the hunger for the new loses its ethical foundation. And I'm not just talking about Italian futurism as a historical curiosity. I'm talking about it as a warning that applies right now to every person building toward futures today, including me and including you. When I say Jewish futurism with a lowercase f, I'm deliberately separating from Italian futurism with a capital F. That separation is not just stylistic. It's a statement of my values. It's me saying we are building something different here, something rooted in repair, tikkun, not destruction. Something that learned from what went catastrophically wrong, and something that can appreciate the visual genius of Italian futurism while refusing to inherit its moral failures. So let's look at what went wrong, and let's start with something I want to be honest about regarding my own practice, because I think it shapes everything that follows. One of the most important steps I've taken as someone who practices and teaches Jewish futurism is studying all of the preceding and concurrent futurist movements. Not just the ones that share my values, all of them. Italian futurism, Afrofuturism, Gulf futurism, solar punk, biopunk, Sino-futurism, queer futurism, Latin futurism, the full spectrum of movements that have tried in wildly different ways to imagine and build towards something new. I do this because understanding what I'm actually doing requires seeing the entire landscape. When you study other futurisms, you can observe and evaluate the decisions previous futurists had made. You can see what choices led to liberation and what led to catastrophe. You can ask, what made this movement resilient? What made this one collapse or get absorbed by power? What values protected the communities? And what ethical gaps left them exposed? This comparative study is how Jewish futurism sharpens itself. It's the same instinct that drives Talmudic study. You don't just read the ruling, you read the arguments, you read the dissents, the edge cases, and the failures of reasoning. You don't understand the whole conversation in its full complexity and contradiction, so you can contribute to it wisely, so that when you finally speak, you know what you're actually saying and why it differs from everything that came before. It's important. So when I teach Italian futurism to my design students and watch their discomfort when the politics of the movement emerge, that discomfort is the lesson. It's the moment of ethical awakening that I want every futurist to have early, before they've built something they then can't take back, before they've let the intoxication of the new crowd out the harder, slower work of asking, is this actually good? And for whom? And at what cost? Now, let's understand where Italian futurism came from, because it didn't emerge from nowhere. Every futurist movement is a response to a specific historical wound. A community or culture looks at the present circumstances and says, this is not enough. We can imagine better. We must build towards something new. The wound shapes the medicine. And when you understand the wound Italian futurism was responding to, you understand how it went so wrong and so fast. Italy in 1909. The feeling of humiliation. It felt left behind by new industrialization, overshadowed by its neighbors, Germany, France, and Britain. It felt culturally stagnant, weighed down by centuries of reverence for ancient Rome and Renaissance glory. Young Italian intellectuals were suffocating under the expectation that greatness was behind them, that the best Italy had ever been was in the past, and the present was just a long, slow decline into irrelevance. Here's a concept I use a lot in my work that applies directly to this movement in Italian history, forstalgia. Forstalgia is nostalgia for futures that never were. It's the creative grief work of mourning lost possibilities, you know, when you like think, oh, that'd be great, of sitting with the timelines that didn't happen and asking what they can teach us. The word breaks down pretty simply. For means forward, in front of, ahead. Alja means pain of or longing, the same root in nostalgia. Put them together and you get the pain of the future that never arrived. I'll explain more about how I use forstalgia productively later in this episode, but I want to name it because the Italian futurists were experiencing a distorted version of it. They were grieving a future Italy that had never arrived, a modern vital nation that kept failing to materialize. And instead of using that grief productively to extract values, to understand what actually mattered underneath the longing, they weaponized it. They turned creativity and grief into rage. They decided the cure for a future that never came was to burn down everything that stood in its way. That is forstalgia gone completely wrong. That's what happens when you feel the loss of a possible future, but skip the step of asking, what was actually valuable about that lost timeline in the first place? What principles can I carry forward? Instead, you just reach for the destructive tool. Filippo Tommaso Marinetti felt that suffocation acutely, and on February 20th, 1909, he published the Futurist Manifesto on the front page of Le Figaro in Paris, which was a deliberate provocation, launching an Italian cultural movement in a French newspaper to make a point about Italy's need to be seen, to matter, to thrust itself forward into the modern world. The manifesto was electric. It was outrageous. It was totally designed to shock. Marinetti called for the destruction of museums, libraries, academies of all kinds. He called for the glorification of speed, the machine, the crowd, and the factory. He said, "We want to demolish museums and libraries, fight morality, feminism, and all opportunist and utilitarian cowardice." He said that they wanted to glorify war. And here's the thing. The hunger underneath it all was actually very real. The desire to break free from stagnation, to claim a vital presence rather than a glorious past, to make art that felt alive and urgent and genuinely new, that was a legitimate creative hunger. That's not so different from what drives any futurist movement. But Italian futurism answered that hunger with destruction rather than repair. It said that the cure for being trapped by the past was to obliterate the past entirely. Burn the museums, tear down the institutions, start from zero on a foundation of speed and violence and masculine energy. Compare that response to how other movements answered similar hungers. Afrofuturism emerged from communities that had their past deliberately stolen, erased, or forcibly forgotten. But rather than responding to that theft with more destruction, Afrofuturism centered Sankofa, the Ghanaian concept of reaching back to retrieve what was lost and to bring it forward. It said, "The past is not the enemy. Our disconnection from the past is the enemy. And healing requires reclamation, not obliteration." Jewish futurism emerged from diaspora, persecution, and survival against overwhelming odds. It could easily have generated a movement of resentment, of burning down what others had built on Jewish exclusion and suffering. Instead, Jewish futurism decides to carry the past forward. It treats Torah, Midrash interpretation, history, and memory not as prisons, but as engines. It says, "We are not trapped by our past, we are fueled by it." The wound Italian futurism was trying to heal was very real, but the medicine it chose was poison. And studying that contrast rigorously, comparatively, across movements and eras, is how you learn how to tell the difference between a futurism that liberates and one that destroys. Now let's get specific about what actually went wrong. Because Italian futurism's failure wasn't random, it was well-structured. It followed from specific choices that the futurists made, and those choices had consequences that compounded over time until the movement had become something its early participants might not have fully anticipated, or in some cases, embraced without hesitation. Okay, the first and most fundamental failure was that aesthetics replaced ethics. Italian futurism was obsessed with how things looked, felt, and registered in the body. Speed, energy, dynamic force, the intoxicating aesthetic experience of modernity, the roar of an engine, the blur of a city light at night, the explosive geometry of a crowd in motion. That obsession was total and genuine and produced genuinely extraordinary art. Art that, as I said earlier, went on to reshape architecture, product design, graphic design, and visual culture broadly. The influence was real and lasting and is still with us today. But that obsession was so complete that it crowded out any ethical framework. There was no question underneath the beauty asking, what is this for? What does it do for people? And who does it serve? Marinetti found war beautiful. He found violence exciting. He wrote about the pleasure of combat with the same sensory intensity that he wrote about fast cars. The aesthetic and the violent became fused in a way that made it impossible to say, this art is beautiful and this politics are wrong. The art and the politics were exactly the same thing in this case. This is one of the most dangerous dynamics in any creative movement. When beauty becomes self-justifying, when the aesthetic experience is treated as its own moral category, you lose the capacity to ask hard questions about what the beauty is doing in the world. And compelling visuals can make catastrophic ideas very seductive. Italian futurism proved that more clearly than most any other movement in modern history. And because its visual language traveled so far and influenced so many other designers and architects and typographers who may not have shared its politics, the aesthetics outlived the ideology in ways that are genuinely complicated to reckon with today. Jewish futurism starts from a completely different premise. Hidur mitzvah, beautifying the commandment. It's only meaningful because there's a commandment underneath that beauty making. The aesthetic is not just self-justifying. It serves something. It elevates something that already has ethical content to a higher place. When I design a ritual object, I'm not just asking, does this look extraordinary or Jewish? I'm asking, does this help someone cross a threshold? Does it make holiness more accessible? Does it serve the practice it's supposed to embody? The aesthetic serves the ethical. That sequence really matters. Switch them around and you get Italian futurism. Okay, the second failure was that the past had become the enemy. Italian futurism didn't just want to move beyond the past, it wanted to obliterate it. Museums became cemeteries to them. Libraries were graveyards. History was a prison. Academic tradition was a cage. The only worthy thing was the new, the fast, the immediate, and the untested. Anything that smelled of memory or inheritance was to be demolished. This is a seductive idea. Every creative person has felt it. The weight of tradition, the exhaustion of being compared to predecessors, the frustration of working in forms that have already had centuries of accumulated expectations and mastery attached to them, the desire to clear the table and start fresh is real and completely understandable. But here's where Italian futurism couldn't see or refused to see. You cannot build a genuine future without understanding your past. When you sever yourself from history, you don't become free. You become ignorant. You lose access to the accumulated wisdom of everybody who tried to build something just like you before you. You lose the hard-won lessons. You lose the warnings written in blood that previous generations left, specifically because they wanted future generations to not repeat their mistakes. This is exactly where the method called backcasting becomes important. Backcasting is a futurist practice of starting from your desired future, the outcome, go all the way to the future, and working backward to the present. So you define where you want to arrive, then you trace the steps in reverse, asking, what has to be true 1 year before that future? Or 5 years before that future, 10, 20, what needs to happen right now to set that trajectory in motion? Backcasting is only possible if you understand your past, because mapping backward from a desired future requires knowing what already exists and what has already been tried, what failed and why, what succeeded under which conditions. Italian futurism rejected backcasting entirely. It had no desired future, really, only a desired vibe or a mood, a desired energy, a desired feeling of speed and destruction and masculine vitality. When you have no clear destination, you can't work backwards. You can only lurch forward. Jewish futurism uses backcasting constantly, even if we haven't always called it that. The Pesach, the Passover Haggadah, declares next year in Jerusalem, before it begins the story. It names the destination first and then traces the journey backwards. Yom Kippur asks you to envision who you want to become and work backward to what you need to change right now. The entire structure of Teshuvah, of return and repentance, is backcasting methodology. You identify your desired future self and you map backwards to today's actions. How did I start this? And critically, Jewish futurism sits at the opposite pole from Italian futurism's relationship to the past. Our entire tradition is built on the insistence that the past travels with us, not to imprison us, not to prevent innovation or change or genuine newness, but to inform us, to give us the depth and the perspective we need to build something that actually will last. This brings me to one of the core concepts of Jewish futurism, Lador Vidor, which means from generation to generation. Lador Vidor is both a description of how Jewish tradition works and a design principle for how to build things worth keeping. It says, you are a link in a very, very long chain. What came before you shaped you, whether you know it or not. What you build now will shape those who come after you, whether you intend it or not. That accountability runs in both directions across time. Lador Vidor means you are always simultaneously a descendant and a future ancestor. You are receiving something and you are passing something on. The question is, what kind of ancestor will you be? What will you transmit? What will you preserve for the future? And what will you transform now that will be different later? And what will you be responsible for having left behind to those descendants? Italian futurism had no Lador Vidor. It was so fused with the present moment, so committed to the intoxicating rush of the new, that it couldn't hold the past and the future simultaneously together. It collapsed time into a single breathless now, and in doing so, lost its capacity for wisdom. The third failure was that violence was aestheticized, made into pictures. Italian futurism didn't just tolerate violence as an unfortunate side effect of its political commitments. It glorified violence as an aesthetic experience. Speed and war and machines and destructions were created as sublime, as beautiful, as thrilling in a way that demanded celebration rather than interrogation. This is one of the most dangerous things a creative movement can do. Art has a unique power to make things feel natural, inevitable, and desirable that should be questioned and resisted. When you use that power in service of violence, when your aesthetic framework trains people to find destruction beautiful, you are doing something that has real consequences in the world. You are manufacturing consent for harm. Marinetti wrote about war with the same intoxicated language he used for some fast cars and electric lights. He made it feel like the same category of experience, modern, dynamic, alive, in a way that peacetime never could be. And that aesthetic framing mattered. It prepared ground. It made certain things feel possible, even desirable, that might otherwise have generated resistance in people. Jewish futurism inherits a tradition that has been on the receiving end of aestheticized violence for millennia. We know what happens when power decides our destruction is beautiful. We know what it costs when others find our suffering visually compelling, when our persecution becomes someone else's heroic narrative. We know this in our bones, in our liturgy, in our collective memory in ways that make it possible to be casual about the aestheticization of violence. This is part of why Jewish futurism insists so hard on centering human dignity, not as a nice-sounding value added to the top of the creative work, but as the foundation of the creative work, as the first question you ask before making anything. The fourth failure of Italian futurism was that it merged with state power. By the early 1920s, Italian futurism had largely folded itself into Mussolini's fascist regime. Some futurists made the transition eagerly, seeking in fascism the political expression of everything that they had been advocating for aesthetically: speed, violence, nationalism, and the destruction of the old order and the emergence of something new and vital. Others were more reluctant, but found themselves absorbed into the machinery anyway. Their aesthetic language repurposed for propaganda that they didn't fully endorse. Marinetti himself had a complicated relationship with fascism. He joined the fascist party, then had conflicts with Mussolini, then returned back to it. He tried at various points to maintain the Futurists' independence as an avant-garde art movement separate from the state ideology. He failed at that. The movement he created was too aligned with the values of the fascist project to maintain meaningful independence from it. And here's what makes this particularly painful from a design history perspective. The visual language that Italian Futurism developed, which had been genuinely innovative and genuinely influential on, as we said, architecture, graphic design, product design, and typography, that language got absorbed into fascist propaganda and used to make state violence look modern, dynamic, and inevitable. The aesthetic genius of the movement became a tool of the ideology. And because that visual language had already spread so far into mainstream design culture, it became very difficult to disentangle the aesthetic from the politics. This is a warning for every creative movement, including Jewish futurism. When you lack ethical grounding, when you haven't asked the actual hard questions about power and who benefits and what you're actually building towards, power will fill that vacuum. State power, corporate power, ideological power, institutional power, something will come along and use your aesthetic framework to serve its own ends, and you can't do nothing about it after that. The Jewish tradition of prophetic independence is specifically designed to resist this. Prophets spoke from outside the palace, not inside the palace. They told kings things kings didn't want to hear. They maintained the capacity to say, this is wrong, even when wrong was what power wanted. That tradition of independence, of refusing to let any human institution have the final word, is not just spiritual practice. It's hard-won political strategy for keeping creative and ethical movements from being absorbed by the machinery of domination. The fifth failure was that Italian futurism excluded rather than included. The Italians were contemptuous of women. Marinetti wrote explicitly misogynist manifestos. The movement idolized a version of masculine energy that left no room for feminine experience or perspective. It was contemptuous of other cultures, of backward, quote-unquote, peoples, of anything that didn't fit its narrow vision of what the vital new world would look like. And this wasn't incidental to the movement. It was a regrettable side note to an otherwise sound project. It was structural. Italian Futurism's vision of the future was a vision of domination by a particular kind of masculine nationalist military energy. Everyone who didn't fit that template was either invisible or an obstacle. Any futurism that can only imagine a glorious future for some people while treating others as obstacles or irrelevancies is not actually building a future. It's building a more sophisticated version of the present for a narrow group, dressed up in a language of progress and change, just like the Italian futurists. Every futurism that I find genuinely generative builds towards futures where more people are free. Afrofuturism, queer futurism, solar punk, Jewish futurism, Latin futurism, many more. These movements argue, sometimes fiercely, about methods and aesthetics and priorities. But they share a commitment to the idea that the measure of a good future is not how it treats the most powerful people in it, it's how it treats the most vulnerable. Now, I want to come back to the word forstalgia, because I mentioned it earlier, and I want to explain how it works when it's used well, in contrast to how the Italian futurists distorted it. Forstalgia is mourning for futures that never happened. It's a creative practice of sitting with what could have been, what almost happened, what was destroyed before it could fully emerge. Used well, forstalgia asks, what did the Vitebs art school represent before it was destroyed? Not the specific buildings or the specific people, but the values, the radical collaboration, the Jewish-led avant-garde experimentation, the insistence that a small provincial community could generate world-changing ideas, those values can be extracted from the lost future and built into new forms today. Used badly, as Italian futurists did, forstalgia becomes a fuel for rage and destruction. You feel the loss of something that should have been, and instead of asking what was valuable about that, you just burn it down. Whatever reminds you of it is just a failure of that lack of achievement. The difference between those two is exactly the difference between a futurism grounded in ethics and one that is completely not. So where does Jewish futurism fit into all of this? Jewish futurism emerged from completely different conditions than Italian futurism. And those conditions shaped a completely different set of values and methods. Italian futurism came from frustrated dominance. Jewish futurism comes from the experience of surviving despite marginalization, of building and rebuilding in conditions that were rarely favorable, or creating culture and wisdom and community, not from a position of power, but from a position of persistent creative will. Italian futurism wanted to destroy the past, and Jewish futurism insists on carrying the past forward. Italian futurism glorified speed and destruction. Jewish futurism asks, what are we repairing? Who is it for? And at what cost? And then lastly, what will we leave behind? And this brings us back to L'Adore Vidor, because it is really the heart of what separates Jewish futurism from the Italian futurist approach. Every time you're about to build something, L'Adore Vidor asks, will this serve the people who come after you? Not just the people in this room, not just the people alive right now, but the grandchildren of those people and their grandchildren. Will the choices you make today give them more freedom or more options or fewer? The Talmud uses a famous image of planting a carob tree that takes 70 years to bear fruit. Someone planting that tree will never eat its fruit. They're planting it for the people they'll never meet. That's L'Adore Vidor in daily practice. It's designing for a time horizon that extends beyond your own life. Italian futurism was designed for this afternoon. Jewish futurism is designed for the next 7 to 10, even more generations. And this is why studying all of the futurisms matters so much to me personally. I didn't arrive at Jewish futurism in a vacuum. I arrived at it by looking carefully at what other movements got right and got wrong and mapping the full landscape. By asking of each movement, where does it place its values? Who does it center? What does it do with power? What does it do with the past? That comparative study is what made it possible to say clearly, this is what Jewish futurism is. This is what it refuses to be. So let me close with 5 simple lessons, not just for Jewish futurists, for anyone building towards tomorrow. First, ethics must precede aesthetics. Before you ask whether something looks good, ask whether is it good. Italian futurism was visually revolutionary and morally catastrophic. Those two things were connected and not coincidentally. Make sure you know what your beautiful work is doing in the world. Next, honor the past while building the future. You are not the first person to want something to be better. Engage with that lineage. Study it in a comparative way and carry it forward. Don't mistake burning it down for being free. Use your methods honestly. Backcasting only works if you're clear about what you actually want to go. Forstalgia only works if you move from mourning to learning, from grief to design principles. L'Adore Vidor only works if you genuinely extend your time horizon beyond your own interests and your own lifetime. Center human dignity as the foundation of your work, not the decoration on top. The measure of any vision of the future is how it treats the most vulnerable people in it. Ask what kind of ancestor you will be one day. Huge question. Every decision you make today becomes the foundation someone else uses to build on tomorrow. Build things that can be inherited, adapted, questioned, and improved by people you will never meet. That is the deepest form of creative generosity. Italian futurism is such a cautionary tale, but it's also a gift. It shows us clearly what happens when the hunger for the new loses its moral compass. and it shows us why any futurism worth practicing must ask constantly who it serves, what it transmits, and what kind of world is actually building towards. Jewish futurism exists in direct conversation with that failure. We learned. We build differently. We carry our past with us. We ask who benefits. We insist on dignity. We think in generations, not moments. We use backcasting to work from where we want to go. We use forestalgia to learn from what we've lost. And we use Lador Vidor to stay accountable to people we've not even been born yet. That's the work, friends. That's the practice. That's what it means to be a Jewish futurist in this moment. If this episode hit differently than you expected, share it with another futurist, another designer, another creative person who is building towards tomorrow and hasn't yet asked the hard questions enough about what they're actually making. Until then, think long, build carefully, and ask what kind of ancestor you will be one day. I'm Mike Wirth, and this has been the Jewish Futurism Lab. As always, you'll find transcripts, show notes, and my full article, What Went Wrong with Italian Futurism and Why Every Futurist Needs to Know, all live at MikeWirthArt.com. Until next time, friends.